This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are men and women with remarkable stories to tell if we only take the time to listen. And that's what we do each week as we honor veterans for their service and sacrifice. We try to preserve their stories so we won't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, how much do we learn? We are educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And there are few things as inspiring, as unifying, as patriotic, as satisfying as the phenomenon known as honor flight. We're going to get a taste of that today. If you're a regular listener to Hometown Heroes, I'm guessing you're familiar, but here's a quick overview. The National World War II Memorial was not completed until 2004, funded by nearly $200 million in private donations, mostly from World War II veterans themselves. That was 60 years after the war, and most of the 16 million Americans who served in World War II had already left us. Of those who remained, many were not in the position or the condition to travel and visit the monument. And one man's idea to fly a veteran friend of his to Washington has mushroomed into a nationwide effort to take World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial. You'll find local nonprofits dedicated to this cause all over the country as part of the Honor Flight Network, and no matter what station you're listening on today, there is an Honor Flight affiliate near you. This past week, I had the privilege of sending off and welcoming home 63 World War II vets who took that sentimental journey, and I thought I'd share a little taste of that with you. A P-51 Mustang did a high-speed flyby and then came around and landed for the vets to get a close-up view at the send-off ceremony from the historic runway at the former Castle Air Force Base in Atwater, California, where another World War II plane, a C-54 piloted by Sam Knobb, timed up its flyover with God Bless America.
God bless America, land that love, stand beside her and guide her through the night with the light from above.
That was the beautiful voice of Michelle Allison leading the way. The veterans headed to Washington, D.C., where they saw the memorial built in their honor, as well as the other major monuments. They witnessed the changing of the guard at Arlington National Cemetery. And when they landed back in California a couple days after they left, six high school cheer squads, the Atwater High School Band, and a spirited crowd welcomed them home.
Let them hear it, Central Valley. These are the folks who put their lives on the line for us. Welcome home, veterans.
They kept that spirit coming until the final veteran had been wheeled down off the plane and through all that red, white, and blue. I've got a few photos of that on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page if you'd like to take a look. And we're going to hear the story of one of those 63 veterans today on Hometown Heroes. He had a few poignant words to share after returning to that powerful and patriotic reception.
I was kind of getting worried about our country, but the way it ended up back there with a school kid and the way it was right here, I feel like we're not lost.
That is 92-year-old Jim Morris, who served in the Army Air Corps during World War II. You'll hear more of his summation of honor flight a little later in the show. I first met Jim about 5 years ago, but most of you listening now never heard that conversation. At that point, Hometown Heroes was on only one station as opposed to all the affiliates who air the program these days. And I was talking to him then because Jim's face was about to grace a mural in his hometown of Exeter, California, along with other Exeter natives who served on B-17 flying fortresses during World War II. I started out by asking about December 7th, 1941, and if he remembered how he found out about the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
Absolutely. I was in Los Angeles at the rodeo grounds in East Los Angeles, and I was down there because I went to Cal Poly, and we were down there showing cattle and stuff. And the rodeo was in the last afternoon, and they didn't say anything about the Pearl Harbor or anything until the rodeo was over, and then at 4 o'clock they started in with newspaper hawkers, you know, coming through holding it up, and everybody was just dumbfounded, and I was. And it took us hours and hours to get back to San Luis Obispo that night, I'll tell you. It was just a mess.
So many cars on the road?
I saw a few, and every 10 miles, the highway patrol stopped us going up 101 and checked us, and we were in a 35 Ford with a rumble seat. Two of us was in the rumble seat, and so we had to get out every time and so they could check us out and look in there and see what was there, if anything.
You know, I think a lot of people forget about that, especially if they were somewhere further away from the coast, but they're so close to the coast, they're looking for Japanese and Japanese Americans.
That's right. So they stopped it. I mean, it was a stop on the highway, 101, and of course that goes right along the coast, and they were afraid they were subsided off the coast, they said, and so consequently they weren't taking any chances.
And I also find it interesting that the rodeo was more important. They had to make sure nobody left the rodeo before it was over, huh?
Evidently that's what it was, but I guess they didn't want to scatter everybody because the minute, you know, that if they'd have said it at 1 o'clock or something, well, it would have been a big mess, and it was a big mess anyway, but at least everything was over.
So you were a student at Cal Poly at the time. Did you think, you know what, I'm probably going to have to get in this war at some point?
Well, yeah, I didn't even think about it that day, but in a few days or time we thought about it a little bit, I joined the Air Force and Army Air Corps at that time. And consequently, they didn't take you right away, although they said, I want you, you know. But so I left after that semester and I went in the spring or early summer.
So you knew right away that you wanted to take this into your own hands and join yourself instead of waiting for them to draft you?
Well, because I just felt like if I was going to have to do something, I'd rather do it on, you know, volunteer and ready to go. And I wanted to be in the Air Force rather than the infantry or sailors or something else, you know.
Now, I asked, every time I interview someone who served in the Army Air Corps, I ask this question, I think, because so many have told me, whether they ended up as gunners or navigators or radio men, that the reason they chose the Air Corps is they wanted to be pilots. What about you? Were you thinking maybe you would be flying a plane?
Well, I joined with the idea of whatever they wanted me to do, but I had in my mind, yeah, that I wanted to be a flyer, but they said we need gunners and we need armor gunners, which take care of the bombs and stuff on a B-17 or whatever I was on. So that's where I went, and I was happy to do it. I mean, I didn't care which way I went. They were full up at the time with air cadets, and so I say everybody was joining or being drafted or, you know, taken in. So consequently, they needed gunners more than they needed right then. They needed pilots. Like, not that they didn't need pilots, but what I'm saying is they had so many different varieties to do that's where they sent you. So that's what I did.
And I'm curious. Now, I'm talking to you here on your property outside of Exeter, the same area where you were born, and you just came in from feeding all your horses. And I'm curious if growing up in a ranch setting where you had to get out there and feed horses or do all the dirty work, did you feel like that toughened you up a little bit and prepared you for what you were going to face in the service?
Well, I didn't know what the service was going to be like, but I knew that, you know, raised on a ranch, you were always busy and you were always doing things. So I figured, well, it wasn't any worse than that, you know, other than going to war. But then the war was had to be fought. So that was the idea of joining and going.
Was it worse when you hit that basic training, when they made you hike forever or do this or do that? Was it worse than being on the ranch?
No, it was easier because they sent me to Miami Beach, Florida, and I stayed in the Fountain Blue Hotel and marched on the beach.
I guess that is a little different than Exeter. So when they tell you you're going to be a gunner, tell us some of the kinds of things that they had you do to develop this skill. I mean, it's not like you're standing still and shooting at a target that's stationary if you're an aerial gunner.
No, you start out with a ground instruction and learn the guns, the 50 caliber machine guns and so on. And then you go to flying gunnery training, and that was in Fort Myers, Florida, and in AT-6s, I think it was, and out over the Gulf, and you shot at targets and so on and so forth like that, and honed your skills the way they told you to fire and do. And so it was a combination of the two. And you could be you had to have two on heavy bombers. You had to have two things to do. One of them, there was either engineer who was supposed to know how to handle engines, and there was armor gunners who took care of the bombs, which I was, and there was radio gunners.
Well, you know, you talk about the different gunner positions, and I interviewed a guy before who was a radio man and gunner, and he says that when they asked for volunteers for gunnery school, that they actually told them the average lifespan of a gunner in the war was something like 30 seconds or something like that, because that was the actual combat time in the air. Did you ever hear any crazy number like that really raised your eyebrows?
No, I never did. It was just the fact that you were supposed to do your job, and if it took till the end of the war or whatever, that was it, you know. And so they didn't specify you might not make it. That was your own assumption that you might not make it, you know.
I imagine that probably wasn't a difficult assumption to make once you saw the newsreels and read the newspapers.
Well, that's right. But when you was there doing it, you knew what they were talking about when they were talking about short time. But, you know, there was a lot of losses. There was a lot of people made it through, and I happened to be one of them.
Well, and I'm glad you did. I'm glad we're sitting here talking today. Now, eventually, after all this training, you get assigned to a crew and a squadron, a group. Tell me about that, and was it exciting for you at the time to know that, no, it's finally going to happen, this is what we're doing?
Well, it did, and we were assigned into a crew, and we joined, it was in Grand Island, Nebraska, and we were all set, got our planes and everything, and got the brief to go to England. At 11:30 at night, we were unbriefed and sent to the barracks. 5 o'clock in the morning, the people that haul airplanes or fly airplanes around took them all, and we went to Newport News, Virginia, and went on a boat to Africa. So it's either one of two things. It was either changing plans real quick, or one hand didn't know what the other hand was doing. I don't know which.
Do you think one is more likely than the other?
Yeah, probably. Probably, and the latter was probably the one.
Well, you definitely know where you ended up, and you ended up on the way to Africa. Now, growing up on a ranch in Exeter, I imagine you hadn't spent too much time on the open sea, so that was probably a new adventure for you, too.
Yeah, very much so, and I wasn't fond of it. I wasn't fond of it before I was assigned to that thing, but I didn't want to be a sailor, so I knew that. So the 30 days I spent in a convoy going to Africa, that was all the sailor part I needed, and I didn't have anything to do but stand guard at night, and I don't know what guard from, because who was going to get on a plane or on a boat in the middle of the Atlantic, you know? But anyway, you had to pull guard, of course, and so on and so forth. But it was interesting. I used to sit on the bow of the boat, and there was an old Liberty boat, and it wasn't very big, so I'd sit and watch the flying fishes and watch the porpoises and stuff in different areas and so on. And then when we got to Casablanca, in the Bay of Casablanca, there was hundreds and hundreds of hammerhead sharks all around the boats and stuff. I guess they fed with stuff through people threw over. I don't know.
So you didn't sit too close to the edge when you saw those hammerheads, huh?
No, I didn't do that. That was my first experience seeing a shark anyway.
Now, this was still, I'll let you give me the date when this was all happening, but this is still fairly early in the war, and I imagine there was still a significant U-boat threat at that time.
There was lots of activity with U-boats on our convoy going over, and we had destroyers with us, and I don't know who all fires the boat, but there was a lot of depth charges went off at night, and we saw one time right down through the center of the convoy, which was, there was about 150 ships in this convoy of all kinds, and there was a U-boat went right down the middle, and so they couldn't drop anything on it there, and they couldn't fire really without, because we were too close, so they were trying to save themselves, I think, but as soon as they got out the back end of the deal, of destroyers were dropping all kinds of stuff, and they really hammered on those. I mean, the sound really hammered on those old Liberty ships, I'll tell you. It sounded like it was hitting them, but it wasn't. It was just water.
So I guess that was kind of the first thing that told you, wow, this is what war is like. This is for real. This isn't a Boy Scout game.
There was a whole lot of us on the boat, and there was a lot of them, and there were a lot of supply ships. And so consequently, the protection was needed real strongly, and of course they did that. But the U-boats were very active at that time in the Atlantic. And later on, we bombed Marseille, France, which was a huge, not the town, but the U-boat. Germans had a U-boat docking deal there, and it was all underwater with steel plates on top and stuff and like that. But we bombed it several times later on.
You guys did a lot of bombing, and we're going to talk about the intensity of especially 1 month with 24 missions in 28 days, if you can believe that. Right now, we need to take our first commercial break. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page to check out photos and even a little video from that welcome home that Jim received from his honor flight. When we come back, we're going to explore some of the 52 missions Jim Morris took part in during World War II. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. Close to 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.